Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. North and South Korean officials have resumed marathon talks late Sunday afternoon in an urgent bid to avert war on the peninsula. Initial talks that began Saturday were adjourned 10 hours later in the early hours of Sunday. Officials have not publicly commented on the discussions, and there's no word on whether the negotiations are making any progress or how long they will continue. However, as the talks started up again Sunday, South Korea reported unusual troop and submarine movement in the north. Meanwhile, the United Nations and the United States and even North Korea's key ally, China, have called for calm to reduce the high tensions and avoid potential further conflict. Thousands of migrants rode trains and buses and walked through Macedonia and Serbia on Sunday in an effort to get to European Union member Hungary. That's where authorities are building a razor wire fence to keep them from entering. The migrants, mostly Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans fleeing bloody conflicts in their homelands, could travel freely throughout Europe in search of jobs and better life if they can cross into Hungary. The migrants had landed into debt-wrecked Greece, an EU country that's facing its own financial turmoil. The baton-wielding Macedonian police initially kept the wave of migrants from entering their country and heading further north, sealing the Greek-Macedonian border. Meanwhile, Italy's Coast Guard said Sunday that Italian forces had rescued 4,400 migrants off the coast of Libya in a span of a day after responding to requests for help from more than 20 vessels. Italy has been routinely carrying out similar rescues, bringing hundreds of migrants to shore, but the scale of Saturday's operation was unusually large. VOA News. Pakistan's military says a group of terrorists staged a rocket attack from across the Afghan border Sunday, killing four soldiers and wounding four others. The incident happened in Pakistan's northwestern Khyber tribal region that borders eastern Afghanistan. But the Pakistani Foreign Ministry summoned the Afghan ambassador to protest the cross-border attack. Britain reopened its embassy in Iran's capital on Sunday. It comes nearly 4 years after it closed following an attack by protesters who stormed the building. The British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond was in Tehran for a ceremony where he declared the embassy open. He called the visit Sunday a historic moment in relations between the two countries, noting it was the first visit by someone in his position since 2003. Ahead of the ceremony, Britain's Foreign Office and Iran's embassy in London would also open at the same time, initially at the Charge d'Affaires level, with the aim of installing ambassadors at both facilities in the coming months. French authorities have identified a gunman aboard an Amsterdam to Paris train as a Moroccan in his mid-20s called Ayoub El-Khazani. He is known to both Spanish and French intelligence and has links to militant Islam. The people who subdued the gunman include U.S. serviceman Alex Carlatos, Spencer Stone, as well as an American student, Anthony Sadler, and British businessman Chris Norman. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
U.S. President Barack Obama telephoned the Americans to praise them for their actions. They were also decorated by the mayor of Arras, where the train stopped after the attacks. They've been recounting how they attacked the assailant, who carried several weapons and whose Kalashnikov rifle may have jammed. Here's Scarlatos describing how fellow Americans Spencer Stone attacked the gunman on Reuters TV.
Spencer ran a good 10 meters to get to the guy, and we didn't know that his gun wasn't working or anything like that. Spencer just ran anyway, and if anybody would have gotten shot, it would have been Spencer for sure.
Yeah.
And we're very lucky that nobody got killed, especially Spencer.
Stone was released from hospital after being treated for his injuries. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Forces from the United Arab Emirates rescued a British national Saturday in a military intelligence operation 18 months after he was kidnapped by al-Qaeda militants in eastern Yemen. The British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond confirmed the rescue in a statement Sunday. Giant panda fans got two tiny pieces of good news Saturday at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington, announced the births of a pair of new panda cubs. The zoo announced the surprising second healthy delivery by the mother on Saturday. Both sexes of each newborn will be determined at a later date. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
During the night of August 22 to 23 on the island of Santo Domingo, an uprising began which set forth events which were a major factor in the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade.
The UN Human Rights Office has issued today a report which reveals the endemic impunity that is occurring in Darfur over serious human rights violations and abuses that occurred last year in 2014.
Most of these unaccompanied children live near the border of Ethiopia, so which is really easy. They don't need a smuggler. They don't need anybody's help. They cross into Ethiopia and then they are stranded at the refugee camps.
So Vero, about 2 years ago. Those are the...
We begin in Nigeria, where the army chief survived an attack on his convoy Saturday by suspected Boko Haram fighters in volatile Borno State. The army says gunmen ambushed the convoy of Lieutenant General Taku Boratai at a village between the towns of Mafa and Dikwa. According to an army statement, troops responded with overwhelming fire, killing 10 attackers and capturing 5. The army says one soldier was killed in the gun battle, while 5 others were wounded. General Boratai went on to address soldiers and a crowd of internally displaced Nigerians in Dikwa. The attack comes as United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon begins a 2-day visit to Nigeria. The UN chief plans to meet with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, as well as clerics, business leaders, and human rights activists. Nearly 225 years ago, enslaved Africans in what is now Haiti and the Dominican Republic rose up against their oppressors. Their fight for justice is remembered on the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition, observed on August 23rd. The day was established in 1997 by the UN Cultural Agency, UNESCO. For more about the significance of this day, UN Radio's Diane Penn spoke with Emily Glele, program specialist at UNESCO in Paris.
This date is significant because during the night of August 22 to 23 on the island of Santo Domingo, an uprising began which set forth events which were a major factor in the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade. And it was seen as a victory of freedom and human rights. This International Day is to break the silence around one of the most, I would say, horrific tragedies in human history.
You mentioned that this day is a tribute to the victims, but also a call for truth and justice. How does the slave trade touch people today? Is it still relevant, the slave trade and its abolition?
Yes, of course, it is still relevant. You know, the slave trade has an influence on today's society. There were tens of millions of African men and women and children, who were victims of this tragedy. But also from this horrific tragedy, there were links between culture, between country. It is a story from chain to bond, because there was some link between people. And today, we can see it's obvious that the link between Africa, Latin America, United States, the Caribbean, and also Asia.
thank you for mentioning and pointing out how extensive the slave trade was. And at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned you are the program specialist for UNESCO's Slave Route Project. Tell us a little bit about that project.
For 20 years, the Slave Route Project has stimulated research and encouraged the implementation of educational tools in schools, the protection of memorial sites, and even the official recognition of slavery as a crime against humanity by the United States in 2001. UNESCO commitment is also embodied in its organization of the international competition for the design of the permanent memorial to honor the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade, which was inaugurated this year at the United Nations headquarters. Another aspect of the project, for example, in September 2015, the Slave Route Project is organizing a major event entitled Artists and the Memory of Slavery. So it is resistance, creative freedom, and legacies. And this major project will involve artists who played a pioneering role in reflecting upon slavery in their work.
And now, one final question. Is there a message that UNESCO has for the observation this year?
Yes, we are talking about resistance, about liberty, and about heritage. And to that, we can come to recognition, justice, and development. And especially on this occasion, this year, is significant because this year it marks the beginning of the international decade for people of African descent, 2015-2024, which was proclaimed by the UN. And the spirit of this day on the initiative of UNESCO concurs with the decade's goal to promote knowledge of and respect for the contribution of people of African descent to cultural diversity and the development of societies. I will also add that by teaching, communicating, and transmitting this history, we aim to reinforce the rights and the dignity of people of African descent, and also together fight against all forms of racism and discrimination.
That was Emile Glele, a program specialist at UNESCO from Paris. She spoke with UN Radio's Diane Pern. A car explosion has killed at least 5 people in the Somali capital Mogadishu. The explosion at a busy junction on Saturday night came hours after a suicide attack in southern port city of Kismayo that killed 14 people and injured 30 more. The blast in Mogadishu occurred at a busy intersection close to the headquarters of Somalia's National Security Agency. Mohamed Yusuf, the spokesperson for the Interior Security Ministry, told VOA that at least 5 people were killed and 7 others injured. There has been no claim of responsibility for the blast, but Al-Shabaab claimed the earlier suicide attack in Kismayo. The head of the United Nations mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Martin Kobler, has said the mission, MONUSCO, must withdraw from the country. Kobler told reporters last week the recent decision by Ethiopian Airlines to restart flights to Goma in eastern Congo is a welcome step toward MONUSCO's withdrawal. For VOA, Nick Long has more from Goma.
Kobler spoke at Goma Airport after landing there aboard an Ethiopian Airlines jet. Ethiopian is the only international carrier flying direct to Congo from outside the DRC. It started the flights last month, just 6 weeks after a night attack on the airport by gunmen who were repelled by security forces.
Je suis très fier aujourd'hui. Merci bien pour le gouvernement de la RDC, pour le bailleur de fonds.
Kobler tells reporters he feels very proud at this moment and he wants to thank the DRC government and its donors. It is very important to develop the economy here, he says, and this economic link with the outside world is what the people of eastern Congo need. Goma and the surrounding province have come a long way in the past 2 years since Kobler took over as head of MONUSCO. In mid-2013, the M23 rebel group controlled the hills north of the city and mortar rounds were falling in the streets. Under Kobler's leadership, MONUSCO played a key role in helping the Congolese army defeat M23 and improve security across the east of the country. As other crises beckon, the UN Security Council is now anxious for MONUSCO to wind down. We're now discussing MONUSCO's withdrawal with the government, says Kobler, and that also means reducing our fleet of planes. Why use MONUSCO flights if there's an alternative?
nous retirer du pays. Et cette...
We must now withdraw from the country, and having these direct flights here is a step towards that, he says. A spokesman for civil society groups in Goma, Gento Mandu, told VOA the Congolese army was lucky to have MONUSCO's support. He said the groups are concerned that recently MONUSCO and the army have not been collaborating fully against all the armed groups, some of which are still resisting state authority. There's a disagreement between MONUSCO and the army, says Mandu, and we think that's why Kobler, whom we respect very much, is talking of withdrawing his troops. There has been tough fighting in the past few weeks between the army and several armed groups. Mandu said even the foreign armed groups like the FDLR and ADF-NALU contain many Congolese fighters, and civil society could help persuade them to lay down their arms. He says he favours dialogue because that way all sides can be heard and their claims put on the table to see how peace can be restored to Congo. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
A number of Kenyan women are turning what used to be an emergency birth procedure into a must-have in some hospitals. The increase in elective C-sections mirrors a trend in the West and is happening despite warnings from medical experts who say it should remain a last resort. For VOA, Riel Ombor has more from Nairobi.
In Kenya, C-section delivery is becoming more common within the urban population, especially among the well-to-do. The women who opt for elective C-section says that natural birth comes with complications like long hours in labor, physical pain of pushing, permanent changes in their bodies. Jane Mukami is a communications officer with a non-governmental organization in Nairobi. She says that based on her personal research and word of mouth from friends, she opted for an elective C-section.
This being my first baby, I was really afraid of giving birth naturally because of the pain during labor. So I opted to just have a C-section done. And then my peers also were telling me how painful it is, and some even fainted and all that, so I was really scared. And then there's another issue, okay, when you give birth naturally, you know, like you can't like be intimate for a number of months maybe with your husband, and I didn't want to have it that way, so C-section was the best option for me.
Dr. Peter Murimi is a gynecologist at Nyeri Aga Khan Hospital. He says this trend is growing at an alarming rate among young women and is steered by bad advice and misconceptions.
There's a new trend emerging, especially among young women, whereby most of them, by the time they reach, they're almost term, that is, they're completing their 9 months, most of them are opting to have a cesarean section delivery rather than go the natural process because they're fearing the pain. Some are saying that if you have a natural birth, you may have damage in the birth canal and everything, and that may bring out issues later. But you see, those are things which are based on a fallacy, and they're actually baseless.
But Mukami argues Kenya's health institutions are well-equipped to handle surgeries, and that with proper planning, any woman can pull off a safe delivery by a C-section.
In Kenya currently, we have very good hospitals and very professional doctors. So, like, for example, Nairobi Hospital, it's one of the best. And as long as you've planned well for your baby, by that I mean you have good money and you've chosen a nice hospital where they have good doctors, you don't have to worry about anything. You'll just feel safe.
Not all Kenyan women have sufficient money, of course. And according to Dr. Murimi, about half of women who undergo elective C-sections suffer adhesions. He advises that a natural birth is safer than a C-section.
I always tell any woman who's capable of giving birth naturally to use that method. And if it's going to be a cesarean section, let that be due to an indication. Do not just do that out of a preference. Let it be because your body cannot handle it. That is just the final word. A cesarean section should be an intervention. It should not be the first option.
According to the World Health Organization, C-section delivery rates are low in sub-Saharan Africa, being used in less than 2% of births. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Sudanese government and armed opposition groups in the country are being urged by the UN to end widespread impunity of serious human rights violations in Darfur. A new report by the UN Human Rights Office says killings and rape in the strife-torn region last year have largely been dismissed by local police and unreported by victims due to a lack of trust in the authorities. The Human Rights Agency says the report's findings paint a grim picture of a much broader pattern of violence. UN Radio's Maria Calino spoke with the UN Human Rights Office spokesperson, Ravina Shamdashani, about this issue.
The UN Human Rights Office has issued today a report which reveals the endemic impunity that is occurring in Darfur over serious human rights violations and abuses that occurred last year in 2014.
Given the access restrictions imposed on the UN in Darfur, what is the High Commissioner calling for at this point?
We've been impeded by quite a few difficulties in collecting and documenting cases. These include difficulties in getting access. In some cases, we've been denied access by government authorities. In other cases, we've been denied access by opposition armed groups. In spite of these challenges, we have managed to document 411 cases of alleged violations and abuses of the right to physical integrity. These include killings and sexual violence. 127 of these cases involve the use of sexual violence. And these cases are illustrative of a much broader pattern of violence. Given our access restrictions, given the fears that a lot of people have where they're not willing to come forward and report cases, you know, where their rights have been violated because they don't trust the authorities, we suspect that this is quite an underestimate.
Who were the perpetrators of these crimes?
Perpetrators come from all sides. The perpetrators of these crimes include Sudanese police and security forces, as well as armed opposition groups and other armed groups.
Now, in February, the Sudanese army was accused of raping more than 200 girls and women in a northern town of the country, Tapit. But this sexual violence is still ongoing. What can be done to stop this pattern?
The case in Tapit illustrates in a very serious way the difficulties that we have. UNAMID on the ground tried to reach those areas where these allegations were made immediately afterwards, but we were denied access. We were finally granted access several days later, but the Sudanese armed forces were present, and this was really not the kind of environment where we could conduct interviews with people because obviously they would be reluctant to speak freely. After this, further requests for access were denied. But, you know, we've been documenting many different violations in different parts of Darfur.
You just mentioned the reluctance of victims to come forward. What can be done to restore trust so that they actually start to speak out?
The best way to restore trust in the authorities is for the authorities to take seriously any allegations of human rights violations. An independent, prompt, thorough investigation has to take place into allegations of serious human rights violations. And this has to be done in a transparent manner. All the action, the prosecutions, the trials, they have to be done in a very transparent manner so that justice is done and it is seen to be done. Right now, there's a very kind of casual approach by the authorities in many cases to these kinds of violations and to these kinds of reports, which clearly, I mean, in the best case scenario, there's a lack of trust. In the worst case scenario, people actually fear reprisals if they go forward with their complaints.
That was UN Human Rights Office spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani. She spoke with UN Radio's Mario Calino. For many years, Eritreans fled to Israel. Many were abducted, raped, tortured, and held for ransom by criminal gangs in the Sinai. The kidnappers used the cell phones of their victims to demand ransoms from their families. From Stockholm, Sweden, Meron Estafanopoulos tracks the flight of Eritreans on a path that shifted to the shores of Europe about 2 years ago. In part two of a series on Eritrean migrants, The Road to Libya, Meron talked to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C. about the hazards they face.
Meron Estafanopoulos has never taken the migrants' hazardous trek from Eritrea to Europe. She grew up in Sweden and works for the International Commission on Eritrean Refugees in Stockholm. Her job is to interview migrants for a satellite broadcast to Eritrea on Radio Arena. She says she hopes her reports will persuade her countrymen, despite their troubles at home, to avoid the risks of migration and stay home. Maron criticizes the government in Asmara for military conscription that drives large numbers of unaccompanied minors to ignore her advice.
A lot of people do not see a future in Eritrea. Over 4,000 unaccompanied minors, Eritrean minors, made it to Europe. What I see when I speak to these young unaccompanied minors is they're very realistic. They know the kind of future that's awaiting them. So they know that in a few years they will be soldiers like their fathers, like older siblings. So they think fleeing is a solution.
World attention became riveted on the migrant flow to Europe this spring when more than 2,000 refugees drowned in the Mediterranean. The European Union began to debate how to handle the thousands who reached the shores of Malta, Italy, and Greece. But for young Eritreans, the trip starts at their southern border, where Ethiopia maintains two refugee camps, Shemelba and Mayani.
Most of these unaccompanied children live near the border of Ethiopia, so which is really easy. They don't need a smuggler. They don't need anybody's help. They cross into Ethiopia, and then they are stranded at the refugee camps in Ethiopia, and there is no way for them to go back to Eritrea. Once in the refugee camps, they are approached by smugglers who offer zero down payments to get to Libya, which means that child doesn't have to pay anything until he reaches Libya. So once that child reaches Libya, then they contact his family and say, your child owes us this much money. Families feel pressurized to pay because there is no going back.
Smugglers then drive their passengers in pickup trucks through Sudan to Libya. Maron says this is the most difficult leg of the trip to Europe.
It's just the tip of the iceberg as far as what they go through. So the hardest part is, you know, going from Sudan into Libya, where you have to travel like packed in a pickup, Toyota pickup cars that are not even fit for four people. They will put a minimum of 36 people packed like sardines. The car is driving 24 hours for 6 days. Sometimes it goes up to 13 days in the Sahara, where the weather is really hot. The sun is glowing in your eyes. On top of that, if somebody falls from the car and you try to stop the driver, then he would just drop you as well with that person. So you just have to continue. A woman knows already that until she reaches to Italy, she will get raped at least 3 times from Sudan all the way into Italy.
The migrant trail is managed by smugglers from many nations in the region. Ethiopian authorities arrested 200 suspects following the beheading in Libya by extremists of 30 Ethiopian migrants. Last month, the Ethiopian government announced that it is working with the International Criminal Police Organization, Interpol, to repatriate 80 more for trial and punishment.
The smugglers are always Eritreans. Eritreans use only Eritrean smugglers. The smuggler in Ethiopia will send people from the Eritrean refugee camp in Ethiopia. That smuggler will send you to the smuggler in Sudan. So the smuggler in Sudan, who is also Eritrean, will receive you and then will send you to the smuggler, to the Eritrean smuggler in Libya. Once you are at the smuggler connection house in Libya, you will be staying at the house of the smuggler, the Eritrean smuggler, but he's got Libyan partners who will assist him.
While many Eritrean migrants reach Europe, they pay a price. Some of them are children, some as young as 7 years old, who usually travel alone without even a brother or a sister by their side. For them, payment is delayed.
The smugglers have people working under them, pretending to be refugees, approaching these young children, telling them if they make it to Europe, at least they can bring their families legally to wherever they are. So these children miss their families so much. When somebody offers you zero down payment, then of course any child would get that, would take that chance. So these people, what they do is, as the smugglers are very creative, the zero down payment attracts everybody. So once your loved one calls you from Libya, everybody knows that there is no return and you have to pay that money.
Maron recalls several Eritreans whose decapitations were videotaped and posted on YouTube. One of them, Tesfai Kadane, first fled to Israel, where asylum policies were being tightened. Israeli officials deported him to Uganda. Then Tesfai followed the fatal migrant trail to Libya. Maron has interviewed survivors who encountered other Islamic State executioners.
I've interviewed 5 survivors that witnessed the massacre of 62 people getting killed by ISIS. So these 5 unaccompanied children, they managed to escape.
For the thousands of Eritreans who reached Libya's shore and a small boat that may sink, Italy is not far away. This is David Arnold reporting for VOA from Washington, D.C. We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Segun, take it away.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, August 23rd. The 2015 IAAF World Championship started off in Beijing on Saturday. Over 9 days, the Chinese capital is hosting the last major outdoor athletics event before next year's Olympics in Rio, Brazil. On the first day of competition, 4 African countries got onto the medals table. They are Eritrea with 1 gold, Kenya with 1 silver and 1 bronze, Ethiopia with 1 silver, and Uganda with 1 bronze. The highlight of day 1 was the men's marathon final, which was won by Eritrea. In taking the men's marathon title, teenager Gurmay Gebreselassie won Eritrea's first World Championships gold medal. Gebreselassie, who is just 19 years old, won in 2 hours, 12 minutes and 28 seconds on the streets of Beijing. Silver medalist Yemani Sege of Ethiopia came in with a lifetime best of 2 hours, 13 minutes and 8 seconds. And Solomon Mutai of Uganda finished third in 2 hours, 13 minutes and 30 seconds. Defending marathon champion Stephen Kiprotich of Uganda finished 6th. Africa also did well in the 10,000 meters for men, with Kenya taking the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th places. Staying with the IAAF World Championships, a total of 17 athletes are flying the Nigerian flag in Beijing. The team of 3 males and 14 females will compete in 9 women's and 3 men's events. Olukayode Thomas is the official spokesperson for Team Nigeria in Beijing. In this telephone conversation, I asked Thomas to describe the mood in the Nigerian camp and the medal prospects of Team Nigeria captain and Africa's fastest woman, Blessing Okagbare.
Well, the morale is very high. You know, this is the best of track and field in the world. It's the biggest championship. So for even qualifying to be here, for most athletes, it's a big deal. And we are looking at picking some medals. Then God has also blessed us with an athlete called Blessing Okagbare, who is very hardworking, focused, and she, in the last few years, has put herself on the global map. So the attention is on her and what she will do with the Jamaicans and the Americans in the 100 and 200 meters.
You talked about Blessing Okagbare, who is also Africa's fastest woman, and she is the captain of Team Nigeria. I remember that she won her first Olympic gold medal at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Will Beijing also be the venue for Okagbare's first World Championships gold medal?
When I asked her the same question, that was what she told me. She said, for all that she has done in this world, the Beijing medal she won in 2008 as a teenager is the most precious to her. But right now, all her focus here is to win a gold medal. And she's been working so hard. She came before everybody. She's been here for about a week before the championship. She's focused. She's cheerful. She's playful. When you see her, you know that she's not tense. She's not arrogant, but confident that, look, I've done all the things I need to do. With God's grace, I'll be a gold medalist.
Well, Nigeria has never won a gold medal at the IAAF World Championships. Will Team Nigeria break the jinx this time?
Well, you know, the unpaid disability of sport is the strongest attraction. Sport is very, very unpredictable. But we have a potential gold medalist in our hand. With a 10.79, you can be anything in the world in women 100 meters. So Blessing has what it takes to, and even in the 200, she has what it takes to win the gold medal. She has done the hard work, she has done the training, she has done everything. Every other thing is for luck and grace of God.
That was Olukayode Thomas, the official spokesperson for Team Nigeria at the ongoing 2015 IAAF World Championships in Beijing. Away from athletics, the CAF Champions League will have a new winner this year, after defending champion USFC for Algeria crashed out, following a 3-0 loss to fellow Algerian club USM Alger in their Group B Day 5 clash on Friday in Algiers. It was the third defeat for Setif at the group phase, and it effectively killed the team's hopes of reaching the last four, as well as a successful defense of its title. The defeat to USMA was enough to earn Sudanese club Almerek a place in the semi-finals. In their penultimate Group B match on Saturday, Almerek came from 2 goals down to defeat Algeria's MC Yulma, 3-2. The victory takes the Sudanese Giants to 10 points in Group B and further underlines their qualification for the semi-finals. For its part, MC Yulma was eliminated. Turning to the 2015 CAF Confederation Cup, Orlando Pirates of South Africa defeated AC Leopards of Congo 2-0 on Saturday to advance to the semi-finals from Group B. 1 goal was scored in each half of the game. The victory took the Pirates to 12 points from 5 matches. Joining the South Africans in the last four is the Egyptian giant Zamalek, which qualified with 2 matches to go. AC Leopards and CS Sfaxien of Tunisia have been eliminated from Group B. Back to athletics. No Ghanaian athlete is featuring at the 2015 IAAF World Championships due to visa problems. According to Ghana's athletics governing body, Alex Amankwa and Jeanette Amposa could not represent Ghana due to difficulties in getting a Chinese visa. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thank you, Segun. We'll be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. Yes, it's Sunday right here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with some wonderful music from the continent. Here we go.
Mami, na it is a good job, it is a good job.
J'ai donné des mains pour m'imposer. Mon coup est décalé, confirmé. Oh. Ce n'est pas ma photo, c'est Dieu qui m'a donné. Partout en Afrique, on danse mon coup est décalé. Oh. Beno.
Sing it.
Africa,
aye,
moi je t'aime,
abilo, bilo.
L'amour est,
aye,
moi j'adore,
abilo, bilo.
Les femmes,
aye,
je vous aime,
abilo, bilo.
Bisous,
aye,
à tous mes femmes,
abilo, bilo. Sing it. Macaba bereke, mabringa, sing it.
Macaba bereke, mabringa, macaba bereke, mabringa.
Yes, that was our Saturday Mix Spot music from our collection here on Nightline Africa. Special shout out to Akwe Thompson in Accra. Hope you enjoyed the music. And all of you, once it's Sunday, there's wonderful music coming to you from here on Nightline Africa here at VOA. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The man who would wish nothing better than the recognition and legitimacy of the international community for his deed for a third term is feeling very full of himself at the moment. He and his advisers are convinced that they outfoxed and outmaneuvered the domestic and international opposition, and they have achieved a great victory. Last week, ahead of schedule and quietly, they were able to manage an inauguration ceremony of the president. There were no international representation. The truth of the matter is that they have fooled no one. All along, it was very clear that Nkurunziza and his supporters are determined to shoot their way to a third term. They have got as far as they have done mainly because they live in a neighborhood, the Great Lakes region, where there is some doubts or ambivalence about the two-term limit and even some opposition. In their neighborhood in Rwanda, moves are now being made to change the constitution to enable the president to go for a third term. In Uganda, the government and president never believed in any time limit. In DRC, the supporters of the president would wish nothing better than to change the constitution to allow the president to run for a third term. Their main obstacle now is the strong opposition of the DRC politician. And in the sub-regional organization, SADC, the outgoing president, Robert Mugabe, never believed in time limit. And the incoming president, the president of Botswana, surprised many last week when he endorsed the third-term bid of the president of Burundi on the false premise that the Constitutional Court had endorsed it as legitimate. Where was he when the president and his supporters were maneuvering and subverting the court to get the correct answer? Where were he and his advisers when they have mismanaged the Electoral Commission? Some of them have gone into exile. And where is the legitimacy? And where was he, president of Botswana, when scores have been killed because of the opposition to the third term? Or the fact that thousands have fled to neighboring countries because they do not accept the third term of the president? So no one has been fooled about this move. Now, what is now required is for the international community to act promptly. And no one should be fooled also by the magnanimous statement of the president and his supporters, saying that they are prepared to have broad-based power-sharing agreement way beyond what was agreed in the negotiations and the Constitution. They are even saying that they are prepared to be flexible in the Constitution, which says no party with less than 5% should be part of the cabinet. Obviously, they are relying on the fact that greed has been part of the parts of politicians, and their opposition may be tempted to accept a cabinet post. What one should look forward to now is that the international community should deny the president recognition and the legitimacy, and the reaction should be so robust that he and his advisers would rule the day that they conceive the plan to seek a third term. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again next Saturday. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since July 9th, China has engaged in a series of coordinated detentions and arrests that rights defenders inside and outside of China are describing as a serious deterioration in the country's human rights environment. To date, over 250 attorneys, activists, and their family members have been detained, interrogated, and in some cases charged with crimes, says Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski. Speaking at an August 13th press conference following the 19th U.S.-China Human Rights Dialogue, Mr. Malinowski noted that while most of the human rights defenders have been released, many are still in custody. Many, reportedly, have been denied access to defense counsel. These human rights defenders have been described in China's state-run media as money-hungry swindlers who seek to cause trouble and undermine the government by organizing protests, starting petitions, intimidating judges, and enriching themselves through embezzlement. Although police detention of human rights lawyers and activists is nothing new in China, the scale of the recent crackdown is alarming. The United States calls on the Chinese government to immediately release all lawyers and other human rights defenders still being held, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski. The Chinese leadership's recent fourth plenum emphasized ruling the country according to law, but it is hard to have rule of law when lawyers are arrested for defending their clients or when the government equates arguing a case in court with creating a disturbance or picking a quarrel, two of the vague offenses under which lawyers and others have been prosecuted. Rule of law means that when there is a conflict between the primacy of the law and the preferences of the state, the law takes precedence. In China, the opposite appears increasingly to be the case.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.